Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Today on the show, talking about cloud, specifically financial services in the cloud. Now, historically, when we bring up cloud within financial services, the debate can take on religious-like proportions. Tech evangelists sing the praises of the architecture, compliance departments scream it's not secure. IT departments feel, you know, more secure when they can physically go hug that box that's running code in the cage. Until recently, I think everyone felt more secure when remote access was locked down. Now, current circumstances can show that if everyone has to come into the bank in order to operate the system, well, there's just some limitations attached to that. Today on the show, John Winkwitz, GM of Retail and Head of Product Strategy for Community Markets at Finastra, and Tom Fahier, West Region Financial Services Industry Director at Microsoft, talk about banking in the cloud. And Tom, do you have a special fold-out on your card to get that whole title on?
Actually, since then, I've become the U.S. Banking Industry Director, so we just keep making it easier for
you. Oh, man. Yeah, just keep shortening that one. So to paint the industry in broad strokes and say that, you know, we're anti-cloud, I think, does it a disservice. You know, research from Cornerstone Advisors last year showed that an overwhelming majority of banks are thinking about cloud and developing a cloud strategy. And after the report came out, Ron Shevlin of Cornerstone and I discussed on the show that same overwhelming majority had done relatively little to execute or mature that strategy. Now, Finastra's pinnacle core, Fusion Phoenix, is now on Microsoft's Azure Cloud. And as far as I know, you are the only incumbent core that isn't just using public cloud. You've gone all in and are leading the way in how you're using public cloud to actually open up the core, you know, something that's been literally locked down to the bane of the existence of, you know, many banks, especially the community banks, for a long time. So I guess I'd ask, like, did I characterize that correctly? Like, you know, Tom, you look broadly across the industry, you know, and this isn't meant to be, you know, just the Finastra show, but it really looks like of the incumbents, you're the first that really said, no, we're not just going to embrace, we're going all in and charging ahead.
Yeah, well, so the first thing I would say to what, when we look at what Finastra's done is they've not just embraced cloud, but everything from the key areas where clients are really needing the assistance and help. You know, if you think about it, what they've done with, from the payments platform and putting real-time payments out there on our cloud, what they've done with MortgageBot and helping clients on the front end and leveraging our Dynamics Cloud to be able to do that. And now what they're doing with Phoenix and how they're bringing that forward in the main core. I mean, they're really making it easier for banks. And then you wrap all that with what they've done with Fusion Fabric, and it's really allowing banks to compete at a whole new level and really taking a lot of the heavy lifting out for them to make it easier. So yeah, I would definitely call that all in.
All in. So John, what made Finastra decide to make that all-in bet? Rarely do we see across the board, whether it's on the tech side of it or the banks and fintechs themselves, do we see the let's push all the chips to black. But clearly, Finastra said, no, strategically, this is really important to drive that forward. What made you make that choice?
You know, for us, in many ways, it was a pretty straightforward, easy decision from this perspective is we're a software company, not a hardware company. We're a software company. And specifically, we're a SaaS software company. So we are focused very heavily on delivering, you know, multi-tenant solutions, delivering things at scale, delivering software services that can be upgraded on a consistent basis. You know, we don't get into this N minus, you know, five world where customers are running old versions of software. You know, the recognition that, A, we're a software company, we need to scale. Our customers need the latest and greatest, and the market's going in that direction from an innovation perspective, meaning that, as Tom said, you know, if we look at FusionFabric.cloud in Azure and we look at Phoenix in Azure and we look at the open finance fintech market, you know, Phoenix has always been open. We've always been really open. We've had 240 APIs and 62 endpoints in our platform. But what we've done is take it to the next level. And when you go to Azure, you get scalability, reliability, you get performance, but you get innovation enablement at a speed we couldn't do before. Whether it's us developing mortgage bot data insight solutions in 90 days or allowing a fintech to develop an app in 90 days and deploy it to a customer.
With all of the benefits that you just described, you'd think that those were at a relative disadvantage in operating themselves would find that scalability, reliability, and ability to build on top of it very attractive. But, you know, Tom, I'm curious from your perspective, having followed the industry for so long, about 17 years with Microsoft alone, looking at this space, it looks to me, you know, having followed the space, that it was actually the big banks that were the first engaged. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you just think about, Jason, as we go back over that time, it was the big banks that had the back room, right, where they could have the extra technology investments and invest ahead of the curve. And I think the difference that we've seen happen, you know, as a result of the cloud is it's really leveling the playing field, and it's really allowing the mid-tiers and the regionals and community banks and credit unions to really step up and really be able to bring to market capabilities that in the past they just didn't have the budget to be able to deliver on, and nor the ability to make those investments. Now they're able to work with, you know, Finastra and be able to, and on our platform, and really be able to leverage that technology to really enable their employees to be more productive, enable them to better serve clients, and really bring new solutions to market and be innovative and compete at an innovative level with the larger players.
So, John, I'm curious, when you look at, you know, what's changed, if community banks have long been reticent to adopt, they either have a naysayer internally, it might be the CISO, it might be compliance, what's changed now that a community bank would be looking at and willing to adopt, you know, a public cloud as part of their solution?
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think the change factors have been really accelerated in a post-COVID-19 world. But I generally, I look at three areas. One is the competitive landscape, right? Banks just aren't, and credit unions just aren't competing against each other. They're competing against non-banks. And in many ways, they're competing for relevance at a brand level, right? So customers have the same expectations of their bank as they do Wayfair.com, right? So there's the need, there's competitive and consumer expectations. The behaviors changed with our customers, right? So how do we create engagement in ways that we haven't before? And the third one, which I don't think gets talked about a lot, is the business model's changing. Right. So we have branch transformation. We've got distribution models changing. We have fintech lending that's being part of the standard portfolio. And from a loan growth perspective, we're starting to see banks leverage fintechs in ways to originate even deposit accounts. So those demands require the right level of infrastructure and scale and innovation. And that's what I think our customers and the market in general are starting to see is the value proposition to provide that right ROI and growth opportunity versus looking at it as a negative, it's a compliance, it's a, I don't control it the way I used to perspective before. So I think it's those changes, the ability for our customers to understand, they're just starting to understand the benefits more and realizing they need to go get them. Now they're looking at us to say, how are you helping us do that?
Well, and as we see the different parts of banking and commerce come closer and closer together, I'm glad you brought up the example of, say, a Wayfair, where you'd say, oh, I don't compete with Wayfair. Well, you do, because they're setting a bar for the experience that you're now going to have to compete with, and no longer just on the consumer level. Lo and behold, it turns out that people who work in businesses also use consumer applications and expect a certain level of ease, convenience, data, and ability to, you know, get things done than they, you know, ever have before. You know, the iPhone ruined us in terms of, like, I can do all sorts of things and it's easy. You know, when I look at my 3-year-old daughter and my 80-plus-year-old aunt both can figure out FaceTime, you know, the world of technology has changed. Tom, I'm curious, from your perspective, how do you see the acceleration within digital And how does a community bank or credit union monetize and leverage their data?
Sure. So I guess the first thing I would say is, given the current times, the acceleration's at an all-time high, right? I mean, the first thing I would give you there, Jason, is the number of banks that weren't even considering it, given the time we're going through now with COVID, definitely are. And I think it's really taken a lot of banks from the we never will or we're going to someday soon to we need to now. So I think we're seeing a real acceleration. I mean, Satya said we in 2 months accelerated digital 2 years, right? And it was a very, very true statement when you think of it. Now, from that, the pieces that play into that is first and foremost them leveraging cloud in ways they never had to be able to take care of remote scenarios. And these remote scenarios we're going through now won't be short term, but long term, these scenarios, I think a lot of clients are going to adapt to more digital ways and digital usage and digital channels. And then from that, they're going to expect that same level of experience across every channel. So banks are going to need to really be able to do a good job of serving up their information real time and having those real time customer insights. And your ability to be able to do that, you need the infrastructure in the back end to be able to do that, not only from the standpoint of data capabilities like we do with Azure Data Arc, but also from the core capabilities. You know, when you think before looking at core, you look at things like payments and what happened with things like Zelle, and you go, oh, wow, I can send money. It's there quick and easy. Well, that used to be a nice to have option. Now it's the bar for cores in general, whether it be payments or the main core and or just transactions as we go forward. And we're going to continue to see that drive to digital. We're going to see more digital banks pop up. And we're also going to see more of the movement of that to channels as banks look to reduce costs, but increase the service levels they provide clients to the convenience of the way the client wants to bank with the bank.
John, how would you respond to that? Is that what you're hearing when you're out talking to the market? Is this something that, you know, banks are beginning to really get their head around, especially the smaller institutions where, you know, for the longest time, a smaller bank hasn't felt the pressure from either the larger banks that aren't in their branch footprint or from the fintechs that are bringing that convenience and that scalability and those new factors to them? Is this something you feel like this is a groundswell change within how the industry thinks about the business it's in?
Yeah, I really do. And you can see that even when you talk to FIs that are out in rural areas, how important digital is and how much focus there is on from those FIs as a whole. And it makes sense, right? So to Tom's point, right, we've had this emphasis on digital banking, but the pressures on our customers, regardless of size, are equal in many ways. And so understanding how we can drive efficiencies in different channels and from the front office to the back office is super critical. And if we go back to kind of the talking point here for us, architecture matters, right? So that's why we're all in with Azure, because for us, we've created the right architecture that enables that innovation, particularly around data, which Tom hit on and rather well. Is it's one thing to have a lot of data. It's another thing to be able to take that data, embed it into your products and services, whether it's customer facing and back off or back office, and then help our customers drive their business forward. So yeah, customers of all sizes and all geographies are saying, hey, how do you help me in the sales and servicing channels and digitizing that as well and transforming?
So one thing that I think often gets overlooked when adopting new technology and looking for this ROI is the investment that has to go on after implementation is done. That we don't magically, you know, flip a switch. We did the core conversion, adopted a new technology, did a new integration with a fintech partner, and it magically, you know, we built it and they will come. Only works for Kevin Costner. So when a bank of any size starts to think about making this change to both a level of openness and towards public cloud, what investment do they need to make on their side in order to be successful?
Yeah, so I take that first, right? I think it's a great question. It's not asked enough, to be honest, and you're dead on, right? What I don't think people realize enough, or we don't give enough emphasis to your point, is the change impact that it has to your business, right? If you're going to open up channels in ways that you haven't before, you have to address the operational impact. Is there an investment there I need to make? Do I need to streamline some of my back offices so that I'm just not adding cost on the back while I open up new channels on the front? What's my risk appetite? fraud migrates to the path of least resistance, right? So, you know, you have to make sure you understand what the risk profile looks like in certain channels. And then you have to think about staff and training, right? So if the branch is changing to more of an advisory role, well, how are you enabling technology to have that shoulder-to-shoulder tablet conversation? Because it's not the world we live in where everyone waits in line and you give your envelope to the teller and they transact and you leave. So,
yeah,
you know, you got to think about change management, everything in your organization. And my recommendation always is create a transformation process. Don't try to open up 20% of your accounts online in year one. It's likely unrealistic because the change impact will be too great. And again, with Phoenix, what we have is we have a platform, and quite frankly, we have a business in community markets, which allows our customers to transform. So whether they're starting a direct digital bank, we can help them, and then we can supplement that with analytics to help them understand what we're doing. Or if they're moving more into the commercial segment, well, Phoenix allows you that flexibility of retail versus commercial. So understand what your transformation path should look like. Make the right investment in the end-to-end organizational components so that you can be successful.
Well, Tom, what would you add to that? You know, you see a lot of this and you've probably seen some go good and some, you know, not so good. What would you recommend?
Yeah. One thing I would say is as they open up and they go forward with leveraging the cloud and like a core scenario, and they go to do more open scenarios and third-party partnerships, is making sure they put the right security measures and compliance measures in check, right? Because once you start doing businesses with third parties like that through to your clients, it opens up a whole new area that they need to factor in. So I think that's one area. And banks are getting really smart about what they need to be doing there. We try to, as a leader in security and compliance, put as much of that as we can into the platform for them. But I think that's an area that you'll continue to see as they open up new partnerships and growth opportunities. The other area I would tell you is this area of the opportunity that you see more business liaison roles and more analyst roles being more productive to leverage those capabilities of the core and the data by doing these low-code, no-code scenarios that we really see banks being able to innovate. So I think that, you know, when I look at the cost factor and the focus, some of the stuff that you streamlined that in the past were higher maintenance costs to your legacy systems, you're now able to redeploy those sources and those budgets to the actual ability to be able to do these new low code scenarios and really generate new revenue streams for the bank and bring new services to market. And I think that's the opportunity here that really, you know, as they go forward, becomes the greatest part for them.
That's a great jumping off point to talk about what's coming up in the future. What excites you both? And, you know, Tom, why don't you keep talking first? When you think about what's coming down the line next, that this opens up for a bank of all sizes, right? It's the level playing field aspect that I think is most exciting. But what new advances technologically does this idea of being in cloud and future-proofing your infrastructure by being on a provider that the, you know, N-5, you know, has gone away. You're always going to be on the current version. You're always going to have APIs being implemented and opening up new systems and integrations. What excites you most about what that future could hold?
I think the part that really excites me the most, Jason, is the element of really putting the focus back on the customer and really helping the customer achieve the journey that they're looking to achieve. In fact, proactively being there for the customer. And this whole notion of the invisible bank, the bank that's always there, always on, always with the client, helping them achieve their journey and goals. But really, it's truly invisible. You're just a part of their daily life and how they act and integrate and go forward to achieve the goals they have. And I think that that's where we're going. We're going to that notion of an invisible bank down the road. And the technology powers that capability for the bank to just seamlessly be a part of an individual's life and achieve their goals. It's exciting time.
Well, it's exciting again, but that also requires, you know, I don't know many banks that recognize the most powerful thing they can be is invisible, right? You know, it's an overused analogy, but I can't think of a better one. But back in a day when I used to travel every week, you know, going to the airport and, you know, what's the best part about paying, you know, the Lyft or the Uber driver is the fact that you don't pay the Lyft or the Uber driver, you get out. You're not fumbling for a card, you know, with the bags, right? The payment has become invisible and that's why it's powerful.
Exactly.
Yeah. So John, I'm curious, from your perspective, you know, what's coming down the path that's got you excited?
Yeah, I think to kind of add on to Tom's point, who brought a customer perspective, when I think about our clients and financial institutions, it's the ability to create a business strategy that I almost call it a plug and play, right? So in this open world, we're going to provide options. I mean, customers are going to want to do KYC and AML different, and different providers are starting to pop up. And so our customers can start to tailor and customize in a very low friction way how they build this invisible bank that we often speak of. And I think the other side of it is that, you know, again, like I just said, we start to remove the friction, we create a really true best in breed platform, and we can start plugging in different endpoints. But I just go back to data. The amount of data that we'll be able to bring to light that's actionable and insightful for our customers to deliver that experience that Tom just mentioned about being relevant, I'm super excited about that, because I think that that drives growth, that drives retention, that drives bottom line value for our customers in a very, very challenging environment. So I'm excited about what the future holds.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up the data piece, because that's thrown around, you know, almost a little too casually to say, oh, data, you know, data is the new oil and data is the most valuable piece. And it's data, you know, we're going to turn around and make it actionable. But it does seem like that is one of the most important aspects of what cloud enables from both an access perspective and the ability to actually manipulate it and analyze it and mine it, because it being in cloud, you know, you're going to be able to partner with AI providers and things like that. And then the last mile problem, which is, so now that I have it, what do I do with it? The kinds of partnerships that you're able to build and plug into, that if you're, you know, an on-prem software solution, unless you have 300 engineers standing by, it really isn't going to happen all that quickly. I'm curious from your perspective, John, is that something that is actually becoming more mainstream and understood, that with cloud, the ability to not just compete with a fintech startup, but maybe even do something cooler and better since you have the data, you know, that's actually an edge?
Yeah, it is. And you're right. I think we moved from this conversation where we talk about data as actionable and insightful and engaging, and we all shake our heads yes at the conferences, but we walk away saying, well, how do we actually do that? What does that actually mean? To a point where I describe it this way, right? Finastra builds online account opening software. We're not in the marketing and acquisition and hunting business. But we've got a bunch of data. Our partners have new ways that they're looking at identifying the right deposit opportunities for our customers, whether it is AI and ML-based models to do digital buys, or AI and ML-based models that will help identify what the right influencer sites to be on, right? So we can actually start to leverage data in a way to help our customers lower their acquisition costs. That's a very real thing. Similarly, we have the ability to take new risk models that are much more advanced than what we would typically look at from a FICO perspective, start to ingest them in a collections module, and really start to turbocharge revenue recovery in ways we couldn't before. And what I mean by that, it's, you know, the collections business is all about, you know, where can I put my focus? How do I, you know, what's the best opportunity to recover revenue? And how do I actually reach John? And what's the best channel to do that, right? So, and I'll give you another example, second looks on credit cards, right? There's a way to plug in third parties there and use data. So it's becoming very tangible and real from a banking language perspective. And I think that's where we're at in the process. We no longer walk away confused.
Hey, well, it's time to take a short break. And after we come back from the break, we are going to have Sherry Davidoff, who teaches with me at Pacific Coast Banking School and is one of my favorite cybersecurity experts, talking about the cyber aspects of cloud. But before we go, John, if people want to read about your partnership with Microsoft around Azure or some of the things you've talked about, where should they go? What kind of information is available to get smart on a move to cloud?
Yeah, the best place to go is go to finastra.com/communitymarkets.
All right. That sounds good. That will also be appearing in our social. If you missed that, follow us at Breaking Banks One, and you'll see that in the show notes. Thank you both for taking time out of the day to share your thoughts on cloud and how it is transforming so much of the level playing field within financial services and banking. What are you doing with your abundance of free time during the quarantine? If you're like the team over at Breaking Banks and Provoke.fm, I bet you thought you were going to get a whole lot accomplished only to jump into a task and find out you don't have all the expertise you need. All kinds of hunting around, looking at YouTube videos, finding how-tos, and it still can take longer than you expect. Well, guess what? We turn to Fiverr repeatedly. We are big users of their platform, which helps you find on-demand talent at a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the time that it can take you to do some of this yourself. Find that deep expertise you're looking for. We use them, heck, even for our audio engineering. They help us with infographics. When I'm having trouble actually trying to sketch something out or to develop a PowerPoint presentation, I use Fiverr expertise, hiring a freelancer that can do it, make it look so much more professional in a fraction of the time of what I can. We highly recommend what Fiverr delivers. Search by service, by deadline, price, reviews. You'll know exactly what you're paying for upfront. No negotiation needed. And they serve for 24/7 customer service and help you escrow that so you know that you're going to have a great experience. Check out Fiverr.com and receive 10% off your first order by using the code BREAKING. That's Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R.com, code BREAKING. We're big users, big believers. They will make your life so much better and so much easier. Fiverr.com, code BREAKING.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Here with Sherry Davidoff, CEO of LMG Security, and we're also on faculty together at Pacific Coast Banking School, although I guess I'm not going to get to see you this year. You know, knock on wood, maybe we'll see each other at least via Zoom.
But Sherry teaches cybersecurity.
Virtually teaches cybersecurity to a bunch of bankers. And so happy whatever day it is in COVID world. So let's just spice things up. Cloud is not secure. Change my mind.
That is, as we talked about, I mean, cloud security is a spectrum. It's just like saying something is healthy or not healthy. There is no perfect security. And cloud providers, banks are naturally reticent to move to the cloud. They are late adopters. And that makes sense because when you are on the bleeding edge of something, you're dealing with issues with features, production issues, also security issues. So it's understandable that financial institutions do not want to be and should not be on the bleeding edge of technology. But that said, we are at the point where many cloud providers have mature and sophisticated programs that financial institutions can take advantage of and need to in order to stay current with the times and to provide their community with the features that they need, including very advanced security features. So for example, cloud providers have the opportunity to spend all day, every day, 24/7, focusing on the security and performance of their one piece of cloud software. That is a possibility for many cloud providers. And if you were trying to run that in-house, that's just one of many different things that your financial institution is trying to do.
Well, and that's the part that has always blown me away is this idea that just because you could go touch the server if you wanted to, right? Because it's on-prem and you can, you know, rattle the cage and test that it's locked, you know, doesn't make it more secure than this person who is also responsible for most likely, you know, making sure the printer is also working, you know, helping someone who locked themselves out of their computer, the VPN's down, you know, this host of things you said, let alone the complexity of cybersecurity, which is only getting more complex.
Yeah, I don't want to be able to touch my servers. I want my servers to be someplace super fancy, very high security with lots of redundancy and multiple power inputs and Ethernet and internet inputs and all kinds of stuff. So it's totally fine for your data to be somewhere offsite. If you're going to put all your eggs in one basket, you got to watch that basket, right? And if you're going to put all your eggs in somebody else's basket, you need to make sure that they're watching that basket and probably get some reports on it so you can provide proper oversight of the eggs in the basket watching, if that makes sense. Well,
then what you're saying is, you know, hey, this is actually a fallacy and it's a leftover to say the cloud is not secure. So, you know, in effect, the cloud is secure and we shouldn't have to worry about it.
No, that's also horseshit. The cloud has the potential to be a secure option and the potential to be a very insecure option. So if you are moving to the cloud, number one, you got to vet your cloud provider. There is a vast difference between cloud providers and some of them are much more mature than others. You know, you look at an organization like Microsoft that has some of the most advanced compliance capabilities in the entire world and you compare them with some of our smaller, more niche, more specialized startups that can't even compare because they may not have even close to the amount of resources. So it's not necessarily the case that bigger is better, of course, but we have at LMG Security, my company, we have a checklist of things to look for when you're vetting a cloud provider. Everything from what country is your data located in? Don't let that surprise you. To who has access to your data legally? Have you read those terms of service? And is the data encrypted? How do you know? And if it's encrypted, who has access to the encryption keys? Things like that. So it is entirely possible to create technology to use technology so that your data is secure in the cloud, but you have to verify that that is actually being done.
Yeah, the location is a much more subtle issue than I think people sometimes give it credit once you actually scratch the surface of that, because while you might be working for or working with a cloud provider that is based in one country, knowing where they're mirroring data to suddenly can open up your data to residing in other places because of the nature of how they run their co-location, the other parts of their business and jurisdictions and things like that.
Absolutely. And there's no guarantees. You might just assume, oh, of course my data is in the United States because the person I'm talking to is based in the United States, but don't make those assumptions. And for example, researchers were evaluating Zoom's cybersecurity recently. Some of you may have seen this in the news. And one of the things they discovered was a Zoom key server was located in Beijing, China. And so that sent up a lot of red flags, especially for those of us in the security community, because they have very different laws and regulations with respect to privacy and monitoring than we do here in the United States. So make sure you get it in writing, you understand where your data is going to be stored, and don't make assumptions.
What are the other things that are maybe more subtle on your checklist or non-obvious that, you know, people don't think of immediately, especially as it relates to banks and fintechs who probably worry most about some of the encryption standards, but they might miss some of the other more obvious things?
Yeah, one of the big issues that comes up is terms of service. We see a lot of times people will upload things to Dropbox or stuff like that and not realize that their default terms of service allow them to access your data. Google's default terms of service for most of their free products actually allow them to publicly display and publicly perform your data. So they could publicly perform your emails. I don't know that they would want to, but they could make a ballet out of your emails, apparently. So you really have to make sure you understand the terms of service. Probably the biggest thing when it comes to cloud security, though, is two-factor authentication. And some of your users probably have heard that term. Some of you may even use it. But we need to make sure that it is very easy for people to use it. We see organizations get hacked all the time because of the lack of two-factor authentication. Jason, have you heard of the Florentine banker issue that came out recently?
I have heard of the Florentine banker. At first, it made me hungry, thinking it was a new kind of entree, but it was not. But I think that's a great example, you know, to share for us.
Yeah, so the Florentine Banker is an investigation that was published a few weeks ago by Checkpoint, and they found that there were private equity firms that had been targeted by organized crime groups. The groups broke into their email. It was Office 365. So show of hands, how many of you use Office 365? That's a lot of us. It is the number one most
especially
popular.
In banking.
Yeah, number one most popular email system in the world, and they have very advanced security capabilities. But the Florentine Banker, they were setting things up to intercept people's emails and ultimately transfer over $1 million. They were able to get some of that money back when this was busted, but not all of it. They lost about half of it. So, and the thing is that this is not an isolated incident. For those of us who are in cybersecurity, we see cases like this every single day. I mean, to be honest, I was shocked that it made the news, because 99.9% of these cases, nobody is calling the news saying, oh, by the way, I lost a bunch of money, right? It doesn't happen. But this hits banks all the time. This hits financial institutions all the time. And we need to make sure that we are guarding our email. It is in the cloud. And guys, all you need to do is turn on two-factor authentication. Click that little button, two-factor authentication, use your phone and hit, yes, I've logged in, or hey, actually, no, that wasn't me. Two-factor authentication will save you a lot of money.
So do you recommend the phone-based two-factor authentication, or what else for, especially for banks and fintechs?
I do. And to back up, to authenticate someone, of course, means to verify their identity. And in cybersecurity, we say that there's three ways to verify someone's identity: with something you know, like a password, something you have, like your phone or like one of those little tokens, and something you are, like a fingerprint or a facial recognition thing. So something you know, something you have, something you are. When we talk about two-factor authentication, we mean combining two of these different factors. So something you know with a token or an app on your mobile phone. If you're combining something you know, like a password, with something else you know, like your mother's maiden name, in my mind, that is not super secure. And if you're not using two-factor authentication, you're just using a password, passwords are dead to me, right? They get stolen so often, they're just out the door right away. So you want to make sure that you're using a second factor in addition. I'll pause here, and then I promise to answer your question.
Well, I mean, the two-factor, you know, this is, I think, the nature of security in general. When I was a venture capitalist, I remember learning this when I was investing in the security space, was especially within financial institutions, we tend to buy the highest security we can, but then we implement the lowest security we can because of the inconvenience factor as it relates to it. And, you know, I think of the two-factor training people to have to do two factors, you know, getting them not to keep their passwords on a sticky under their keyboard, you know, is challenging enough. Now you're inserting a second factor.
Well, we use two-factor authentication all the time in banking. I mean, when's the last time you used your ATM card and you took money out of the ATM without a PIN?
Yeah, that's true.
That would be crazy, right? But when ATMs first came out, a lot of them did not have PINs. This was back in like the late 60s, early 70s. Until 1977, a lot of ATMs did not have PINs. And nowadays, if your bank was like, well, we don't want to inconvenience you, we're not going to put a PIN on your ATM card, you'd think that's not a good idea, right?
So we're not going to inconvenience you by like locking the bank vault either. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So in another 5 years, we're going to look back and be like, wow, it was crazy that we didn't have two-factor authentication, that we were worried about customers accepting it. Because you have to. The fraud is rampant. It's for customer protection and it's for the bank's protection. But anyway, back to email. So much money is stolen because people have access to email. And a lot of people don't even realize how valuable your email can be. So when you set up two-factor authentication, you absolutely want to use something like an app on your phone. And the thing to avoid is text messages. Do not rely on text messages. Have you heard of simjacking?
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, yes. There was just a couple reported cases over the last few weeks that it seems like the criminals who are stuck in quarantine are using their time well as they're getting bored, you know, or doing it at increasing scale.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're calling up Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile, and they're pretending that you've got a new phone, and they're redirecting all of your text messages to their phones, and then poof, they can log into your bank account. And there's other ways that cell phones can get hacked. Your text messages are not encrypted. So these days, 77% of Americans have smartphones, and if you are one of those 77%, by golly, use that smartphone, install an app. Those messages are encrypted, they're authenticated. It is just a much more secure method of doing two-factor authentication. And if you're one of the 95% of Americans that has a cell phone, but it's not a smartphone, that's okay. Text messages are better than nothing, but if you can, use that two-factor authentication with an app.
So most of this is related cyber. Does the problem intensify when we talk about cloud? Right, we're talking computing broadly and cyber broadly and emails being hacked. But if someone within a bank or if a fintech company is using the cloud, are they at more risk of some of this when it comes to, you know, if they're at on Azure or AWS or Google Cloud? You know, what does cloud insert that makes this better or worse?
Well, sure. I mean, the thing with cloud is that your data, it can be accessible from anywhere. So that's really convenient for us, especially right now when so many people are working from home. Thank goodness we can access our data in Azure or in whatever other form we want. The problem is if you are capable of accessing it from anywhere, so can the criminals potentially. And so that convenience comes at a price. Because it's not locked behind many different sets of walls, there's that additional exposure. You have to be extra careful. And so you can, in addition to checking on the authentication, see if there's any other types of security features available. Azure is a great example where they have really advanced security features. But to your point from earlier, many banks are not taking advantage of them yet.
Well, it's back to that inconvenience factor, right? You don't want to spike calls to, you know, call center if I'm locked out of my account, and you know, that increases complexity as well. Some people just aren't used to doing things. Now, what do you think of, do we need to get to the point that people are using either a biometric or a physical form of, for two-factor authentication?
I mean, I think that mobile phones are the next appropriate step because you might consider it a physical form. It's at least out of band. Would it be better if we all just had hardware tokens that we kept on our keychains? Sure, that's more secure. But then you end up with some people who have a zillion different accounts and they have a whole key ring of physical hardware tokens. So you always have to balance convenience with security, just like with your health. Like, am I going to eat that donut? I might die 10 minutes sooner. You have to make those choices.
Well, as we're all, you know, getting the COVID-19 pounds coming in, at least we don't have donuts sitting, you know, in the break room and in conference rooms anymore that we can just pick up and snack. I want to switch gears a little bit. Right now, all of this, you know, level of security that banks have to provide or should provide is really left up to the bank to be thinking about. And so when we start with, when we think about regulation and what's placed on the institution in terms of requirements for the type of the security they provide, you know, is regulation keeping up with, you know, really setting standards for how banks should be approaching cybersecurity?
No, regulation is actually absolutely not keeping up. And it's not specific to banks. Regulation is not keeping up with the cloud. And I'll give you an example that comes up all the time in my work. Again, we respond to cybersecurity incidents all the time. Cloud providers have no incentive for making sure that you can detect if there's an intruder in your account. Right? They don't care if you know that someone has broken in. In fact, that probably just causes problems for them. So if hackers from Russia or China are breaking into your account and they're just quietly stealing data and you don't know about it, you know, it's like if a tree falls in the woods, does it make noise? And so the problem we find is that people get hacked all the time. People have their email broken into. The hackers are lurking for weeks or months, and you don't find out until money gets stolen, right? So we've had our industry, the cybersecurity industry has struggled with cloud providers who really don't want to make these features available and have no incentive to ramp them up. And even in cases where we know intruders have been in and we know that a large amount of money has been stolen, often the cloud providers just say, no, we're not going to give you the data. We're not required to do all that work and give you information about when they logged in and who they logged in and what they might have read and what they might have accessed.
Yeah. I mean, the money is one thing, but who knows what else, you know, they took while they were in there and when it's going to come up. And especially if you trickle it out over time, right? Instead of, you know, one giant fraud, who knows how much could be stolen and what they're going to do with it.
Absolutely. And you may not find out until big database of your customer's data hits the dark web, right? And then all of a sudden you're like, holy cow, this got stolen. Where did it get stolen from? We don't know. And that was a year ago or 2 years ago. And then it looks awful because you didn't even catch it. In my mind, it's a lot like apartments and smoke detectors. You know, imagine if there was no law requiring landlords to have smoke detectors in big apartment buildings. You would see a lot more fires. And our government had to step in at that point and say, hey, you know, there's a minimum fire safety standard that we have. And right now, there's no requirement telling cloud providers like, hey, you have to have detection systems in place that people can take advantage of. And you have to give them the tools that they need in order to be able to respond. That's where we are in with cloud cybersecurity right now.
What else should companies be doing to protect their data when they're moving to work with the cloud provider?
Sure. Well, step one is to understand what types of data you're going to store in the cloud. Are you going to store sensitive, regulated information, social security numbers? Often that will pop up in your employee's email, whether you like it or not. Or is it just going to be for marketing stuff or for other purposes? So understand that, and you can choose a cloud provider that will meet your compliance needs. And then you have to vet your cloud provider. So ask them things like, who on their team has access to your data in the cloud? And do they share access with any, quote, trusted third parties? You should be aware of that. Do they do background checks on their employees? Things like that. Authentication is the second issue. So how do you verify the identity of users who access your cloud portal? Do you support two-factor authentication? Do you have the ability to do single sign-on so that people don't have to remember a zillion different passwords for a zillion different cloud accounts? That's another key issue, because if it's not easy to use, it's not secure, right? Otherwise, users will find a way around it.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, ask about encryption. Make sure that you have a qualified IT or security professional evaluate their response to that so you know if they're using strong encryption. Then some bigger issues like, who owns the data when it's uploaded? Who is legally authorized to use it, to display it and publicly perform it and things like that? Where is the data physically located, as we talked about? I would ask about backups, because even if you decide one day you're going to delete all your information from that cloud provider, they absolutely have backups somewhere. So understand that. And then understand if you have access to those backups. I have seen so many cases where businesses suffer some kind of loss. Like, for example, criminals hold you for ransom. It is totally possible for criminals to encrypt data in the cloud the same way they do on people's desktops. And if that happens, can that be restored? And how quickly do you have to notify the cloud provider? You'd be surprised at how fast they will overwrite some of those backups or make it inaccessible to you, even when there's a lot on the line.
So they're going to be overwriting my good data that they could have saved me from the ransomware with the encrypted data, that if I hit it fast enough, I can basically break the chain. Work it back and restore
myself. Yeah, I mean, that's possible. It depends on your cloud provider. If you are not paying for a backup service, then often it is that restoration is not available, even if you think it might be. So definitely double check before you sign up and think like, okay, if my account got wiped out, who's going to restore that? Am I going to restore it from my own data? Is the cloud provider going to restore that? Do they know that? How much do they charge for that? Is it even possible? And then monitoring and logging, we talked about that, and it sounds like a dry topic, but it's so important. Are you going to receive alerts if somebody logs in from a weird place? Are you even going to have access to that information about who logged in and where they logged in from? And does that integrate with your organization's other monitoring and logging programs? And then if you decide to leave and terminate service, how do you get your data out? Can you export it? Is it going to be a pain in the neck? How does that work? The last few are security assessments. So at LMG, we do assessments of cloud providers on a regular basis, and we'll give them a letter of attestation that they can provide to their customers. So I know from firsthand experience that cloud providers all the time give customers these letters of attestation, but usually only if you ask for it. So make sure you're asking about their security assessments. And if they're not willing to answer you or tell you what they do for cybersecurity assessments, that would be a red flag. Check on their compliance capabilities. Do you need to be compliant with HIPAA, with GDPR, with any other regulations, the California Act? If so, make sure that your cloud provider can facilitate that or can at least support you in that effort. And finally, data breaches do happen. If your cloud provider gets hacked, are they going to let you know about it? We've seen lots of cases where third-party providers like billing providers or CRM providers, they get hacked and they might do an investigation. It might take them 5 or 6 months to confirm exactly what was stolen, and then they'll notify you. And then it's going to be your name in the headlines if it was your customer data stolen. So that's it. Those are the 11 points to watch out for.
Well, so it's a long list. And it can seem overwhelming for institutions, whether, you know, you're a tech-savvy fintech, you know, it seems tempting to cut some corners here. Or if, you know, I'm a bank, I might say, I'm just going to stick with what I'm doing, business as usual. That sounds like a lot of work. I realize this is, you know, asking you to paint with broad strokes, but is it still worth it to go to the cloud? Even with all of the challenges and the risks that you outlined, the work that needs to be done up front to make a good decision, do you vote cloud or no cloud?
I mean, that's a personal decision. And it's a decision for every financial institution to make. And you're not going to make it about the every single piece of data that you hold. You're going to say, am I going to move to the cloud for this particular purpose, for my email, for my document sharing, whatever it is? And in some cases, you might say yes, and in some cases, you might say no. And either of those approaches is totally fine. But by and large, we are seeing companies lean towards the cloud as opposed to away more and more these days because they have that ability to scale so much more easily in the cloud. And there are a lot of security benefits. You have teams of specialists, some of the best trained folks in the world that are just focusing on cloud security and working on that one application. So that can be really helpful and a point in favor of the cloud.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I was going to make some joke about what's the likelihood, you know, if you're in Missoula, Montana, that you're going to be able to find some kind of security expert that can help you secure your on-prem data. And then I realized, oh, you're in the middle of Montana, I believe. So that probably isn't as funny for you. But thank you for taking the time, Sherry, to talk about, you know, security in the cloud, and look forward to seeing you at least virtually sometime in the near term too.
Yeah, I'm excited about our new virtual world. Stay safe.
That's it for this week. Thanks to our guests and to our sponsors who help make the show possible. You may have a little more time on your hands right now, so you can listen to all of our more than 300 shows, plus episodes from all of our other shows, including Breaking Banks Europe, Tech on Reg, the Finovate podcast, and more, all on provoke.fm. I hope you like them, and if so, that you'll give all the shows 5 stars and share them with others. Stay home if you can. Take care of your loved ones, and let's all work together to move this industry forward and to make it stronger than ever. That's it for this week. We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.